To the Thursday morning, June 7th, City Council study session. I think that the mayor will be joining us shortly. He probably got caught in some of the Thursday morning traffic that I sometimes get caught in. We need to excuse Councilmember Whalen, who is out of town. And let's make the announcement that item number four, if you're here for item number four, that has been pulled from the agenda. That will come back at a later date. So I don't want somebody to sit through this whole thing thinking that we're going to be hearing on that one. And so, sorry, Gordon, you can go back to work. I know you're heartbroken over that. All right. All right, then we'll go back to item one, which is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the future of Escobedo Apartments.
Good morning. Good morning, Vice Mayor, City Council. I'm Carrie Kent, Neighborhood Services Director. With me today is Tricia Sorensen, our Acting Housing and Revitalization Director. The purpose of our presentation today is to receive a decision from the City Council on the future of Escobedo Apartments. Later in the presentation, Tricia will be presenting our staff recommendation, which is to hire a broker and sell on the open market, and includes a proposed process for vacating the facility, providing tenants with a moving allowance, as well as offering other tenant assistance with the transition. Two other alternatives will be presented with the staff recommendation as well. Before you is an aerial of the property. Escobedo Apartments resides within the white lines and sits on about 11 acres just west of Mesa Drive, north of University. Half of the Escobedo Apartments were built in the early 40s. The remaining half were built in the early 50s. We have 101 rentable units. We have 96 occupied units. We currently have 5 vacant units. Those 5 are currently not being leased until a council decision is made. We have 197 residents in the apartments. 82 residents are below about 18,000, family income about 18,000 or 30% of the area median income, and 14 residents are below 30,000 or about 50% of the area median income. I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Tricia, who will walk you through the recommendations that we have.
Good morning. I believe in your packet with the report we had a pro forma. This is a copy of that. The primary reason we're here today is because of the costs associated with maintaining and operating Escobedo Apartments. The slideshow you see in front of you right now has the revenues for the last 3 years, projected for the next 3 years, as well as the direct costs associated with maintaining Escobedo Apartments. As you can see in this slide, the rents that we're collecting are not covering the salaries and the upkeep associated with Escobedo at this time. As Carrie said, we're not filling vacancies as they occur until we get a council decision on what we're going to do with Escobedo. So the rent revenues that you see projected for 07-08 through 09-010 are probably high right now because we have been leaving some vacant. And if we do make a decision to sell Escobedo and vacate the property, those revenues will go down as vacancies occur. The other thing to note is that we did have a little higher expenditures for this year because of the lead-based paint stabilization project that occurred earlier this year at Escobedo. But the key thing to focus on here is the capital. We have not invested any capital improvements in the site for quite some time. And as Carrie said, the facility was built in the 40s and the 50s. It's an older facility. It's aging. And we do have some infrastructure needs. If we are going to continue to operate Escobedo, we're going to have to invest some money back into Escobedo. What I'm talking about here is if you look at the roofing, the electrical, the insulation, the plumbing, the windows, the doors, they're all 20 to 30 years old. We're getting to the point where we're going to have to make a major reinvestment in the facility if we're going to keep it. We did do some work on the heating and cooling, but as you can see, that was in the early 90s. That's the last time we've done any significant capital improvements on the site. I mean, we don't want to lose sight of the fact that there is a human element to this. We do have residents there that have, and some of them have been there for quite some time. But we also have a responsibility to the citizens and to the tenants to maintain a safe environment. And with an aging facility, we just have to put money back into it if we're going to keep it. Right now, we do not have any capital budgeted for the facility for the next 3 years. We went to the Housing Advisory Board two times in February and March to discuss the disposition of Escobedo. At their March meeting, the board recommended 5-1 that the city consider a mixed-use, mixed-income development on the site and enter into a non-exclusive negotiations with Housing Our Communities. That recommendation came out because Housing Our Communities gave a presentation to the committee. They actually asked for exclusive rights to negotiate for the site with the city. The board did not go that far, but they did say that the city should consider what Housing Our Communities was offering. They also wanted to make sure that the city, whatever we do, that we're cognizant of the impact what a decision will have on the tenants at the facility. We then went to the Community Neighborhood Services Council Committee, new committee that was formed recently, twice in April and in May. At the May meeting, the committee directed us to not only bring forward staff's recommendation, which is to sell the facility, sell the land, sell it on the open market, and actively move tenants off-site prior to closing of escrow through offering a moving allowance. They asked us to add an alternative about conducting an RFP process, focusing on nonprofits, in other words, getting nonprofits an opportunity to say what they would like to do with the property. I would like to say that after each of the meetings that we went to this committee, we also had resident meetings at Escobedo, informed the residents what we were presenting to the committee and what the committee's recommendations were. We had about 30 or 40 residents, no, actually about 40 or 50 residents at each of those meetings. At the committee meetings here, we had about 30 residents at each of those meetings as well. Staff's recommendation is to get out of the business of operating Escobedo Apartments, in other words, to sell the property. We propose selling the property on the open market, entertaining offers from all interested stakeholders. It can be profits, nonprofits. And we also recommend that we vacate the property prior to closing escrow. And to facilitate that, we're proposing a process by which we offer a moving allowance to tenants. This would be a one-time cost that we believe we would get back in the form of salary savings. There are other alternatives. There's a myriad of alternatives. We met with real estate, but the primary other alternatives that we came up with was that you can sell the property with the leases in place. In other words, we don't vacate the property, and then not offer a moving allowance to the tenants. And then the other process is the RFP process that we talked about that the Neighborhood and Community Services Committee asked us to bring forward. In order to implement the staff's recommendations, there are several facets to this. One is we would facilitate receipt of Section 8 vouchers for tenants, which we think is a key component to vacating the property. If council decides to sell Escobedo, that constitutes government action. It allows us to do two things. One, the tenants that are on the waiting list would move to the top of the list, and they would be first served for vouchers as they become available. The second thing is it does give us the opportunity to open up the waiting list again. We did check with HUD, and we do have the opportunity to open up the waiting list again, which is a big issue because we have approximately 25 households right now that are not getting Section 8 and are not on the waiting list. And there was a fear for those people without Section 8 whether they could afford to move out of Escobedo. So this takes, I think, a big obstacle off the table in terms of what council or what we're proposing to council. Just have a couple of slides on the Section 8 program because I'm not sure if everybody in the audience is aware of what it is. It's a federally funded program through HUD. It provides a rent subsidy to eligible, and they have to be extremely or very low income families. They have to pay approximately 30% of their monthly income towards adjusted rent and utilities. Right now we have 19 households receiving Section 8 vouchers. We have 52 on the waiting list and those 25 that are not on the waiting list and are not receiving it at this point. In addition to that, what we're proposing is offering a moving allowance to facilitate the transition to new housing. As we've said before, the residents of Escobedo are very low income. From staff are telling me that the average income is about $6,000 a year. So what we're proposing is because we don't believe that they have the money in the bank to do the security deposits, the safety deposits, pet deposits, is we're proposing that the city offer a one-time moving allowance. It's $1,600 for tenants residing in a 1-3 bedroom apartment, and we have 90 units there, $2,250 for tenants residing in a 4-bedroom apartment. We have 6 units, and then $400 for those tenants who have a lease right now where there's a pet indicated on the lease. Total cost would be about $167,000. We came up with this these amounts based on research in terms of how much it would cost to hook up to SRP, security deposits, and things like that. About half of the moving allowance is geared towards the security deposits, the safety deposits, the utility deposits that would associate with be going into a new unit. The other half would cover the actual cost if they wanted to hire a mover to move into that unit. In terms of what we would do with the leases, we've got 42 units right now on that are month-to-month leases and 54 units that are on annual leases. The annual leases, the last one expires in June of 2008. We believe, in talking with Section 8 staff, that we can get, if we open up the waiting list and everybody applies for Section 8 that is not on the waiting list now, we can get everybody through and on Section 8 vouchers within a year. So we're looking at potentially vacating the property next summer if we move forward with that. We've got 25 on the month-to-month leases. We've got 25 households that are on the waiting list and 17 that aren't. We've got 54 on the annual leases. 19 are currently receiving Section 8 vouchers, so those would probably be the first ones to move. 27 households are on the waiting list and 8 are not. In terms of what we would do with month-to-month leases, if they're on the waiting list, we would continue to renew the leases month-to-month until such time as they get a Section 8 voucher. At that point, they would have 90 days to find another place to live and transition to that new apartment. If they're not on the waiting list and they don't apply again when we open it up, which is a possibility, then they would have 90 days to transition to another apartment as well. For the one-year leases, we've got 19 that are currently getting a Section 8 voucher, so we would work with them initially to get them into new housing. The ones that are on the waiting list, again, they would have 90 days from the time they get a voucher, and the 8 that aren't on the waiting list, if they don't apply, we would give them 90 days to transition out. If they do apply and get on the waiting list, they'd be moved to the top like everybody else, and then they would be given 90 days from the time the voucher is available for them. We would also provide assistance to the tenants. We post lists of properties in the area for tenants anyways. We would be a little bit more proactive with that. We've done research on that. So we would help them as whatever we can in terms of either connecting them with appropriate nonprofits who can help them or identifying potential properties that they might want to go out and look at. We would also seek the assistance of our community partners to help them with, like, for example, driving arrangements if they need to have a ride to go look at apartments. We would arrange for that and possibly packing assistance too. So we would do whatever we can, the staff would do whatever we can to facilitate the transition from Escobedo to a new apartment and make it as smooth as possible. There are some additional considerations if council chooses to sell Escobedo. There are three positions directly supporting Escobedo apartments. We would reassign those positions to budgeted positions elsewhere in the city. We think we've got a year. We think we can do that. We think we've got positions that we can move them into. The salary savings for that, and this is based on the 08-09 salaries in that pro forma, would be $260,000. There are also 19 positions supporting other housing programs not associated with Escobedo but that are housed on site, and we would have to find space to move them to as well. I've got three questions for council. I want to kind of go through the questions and then come back and maybe we can discuss each one. Because this is the big one, are we going to sell Escobedo apartments? If it's yes, then the next question is, are we going to vacate the property before close of escrow and offer a moving allowance, or are we going to sell the property with the leases in place and not provide a moving allowance? And then the third question is, how are we going to go about selling the property? Staff's recommendation is to sell it on the open market using a broker. The other alternative is to conduct an RFP process focusing on nonprofit organizations. So with that, I'd like to go back to the first question and open it up for questions from you or discussion on the first question, which is, are we going to sell Escobedo apartments?
Good. And I believe you have them listed out on issues 1 through 4 on page 3, so maybe that'll be the easiest way for the council to track through as we go. So let's just, I have another question about process. This is a study session. I know they've had public comment at committees and stuff, but we've not had a, will there be a formal action by the council at a regular council meeting in which we will have the opportunity for citizen participation? I guess that, from a legal standpoint, is there any ordinances or resolutions that we need to pass that would necessitate a council agenda on this?
Well, Mayor, if council gives direction now that it wishes to sell Escobedo Apartments, staff will go out and go through the process, and when bids come forward, they will be brought to council, and council will ultimately approve the sale or not approve the sale. At that point, they can certainly receive public comment because it will be on a regular council meeting. Here today, the mayor can accept public comment if you choose to. You're not required to. So right now, we're seeking council direction for the staff to either go out on the market and sell or not. So it's really, you're not required to take public comment today, but you certainly can, or you can post it for a different meeting if the council wishes to have formal notice and accept public comment on whether to sell or not.
Okay, I'd be curious to see if there's any questions on process by council members too that they feel more comfortable with. I know we've sent it through the committee and there have been some committees, and I assume, you know, I've been able to read the notes, and I know the coordinating with school schedules so they can move during off school periods, and there were some others that I thought were pretty interesting comments that we should be able to accommodate. I think they're legitimate ones, and let's try to work with them. I didn't know if there were maybe some others that we haven't heard about that we might be able to modify our process to, again, accommodate the transition if we do decide to sell. I'm fairly comfortable with the public input to date, but I did want to make sure that everybody else was. Let me go ahead and start. Now, I am in favor of getting out of the housing business. As far as owning and operating our own, I think that's a remnant of the 60s, and I don't think that we necessarily do it as well, and I think it's better to disperse individuals in need of affordable housing throughout the community and not congregate in one area. So I still feel strongly about getting Mesa out of the housing business. As far as proactively to have them with the option of a moving allowance and relocate, again, with the idea of not having people congregate in one area with low income, I would also be able in favor of doing the relocation allowance and vacating the property so that the property has the options of additional uses at that site and doesn't have the nuance that we want to keep those people or other individuals in rental apartments forever. I'd like to open that property up for a broader evaluation of what's its best use to date. So that would be the other consideration for me. And then the open market. I have a little bit more difficulty with an open market transaction versus, it's city property, and we also own some property across the street there at Mesa Drive and University. I don't know if there's any synergy between those two or not, so I'm not quite as firm on the open market transaction versus some type of request for proposal on what would you do if you acquired. Are you going to demolish? Are you going to try to re-rent? So I typically would like to get my hands out of it and just turn it over to the free market, but we've operated it, and there's other synergies with the Washington Park Escobedo area that I think come into play here. So I'm more on a request for proposal type of basis on the sale. I'm not looking favorably on a request for proposal for a nonprofit to take the apartments and continue to operate them. Again, for the concept of trying to disperse individuals throughout the city. So those are kind of, I don't know if that reached all of the points, but that's kind of my conclusion having read the staff report. Anybody else want to weigh in on this one at this time? Vice Mayor? We'll go down this way.
Okay. Thanks, Mayor. First of all, in reading through, I noted that at least one person commented on this being more than an apartment complex, that it's a neighborhood. And I can certainly relate to that issue. All of my neighbors over the course of the last couple of years have moved away from me, which I don't know what that says. I'm a little concerned about that. Now that I say it out loud, you know, they've built new houses, they've moved on, they've gone other places, and my neighborhood certainly doesn't feel the same. So I can understand the anxiety that people have. But frankly, I have been very concerned about Escobedo Apartments because I don't think that the city should be, I don't want to say we're one of the worst landlords, because that isn't, we treat the people who are living there very well, but the facility continues to degrade, and it's not a really good, great place for people to live. One of the questions that I have, it has to do with Section 8 vouchers, and honestly, what you've been able to do in terms of contacting HUD and finding out that the list could be reopened and putting these people at the top of the list, I mean, that was just huge, because a lot of the people who are in these apartments, at least historically, a number of them have been senior citizens who, you know, they aren't going to go out and get another job and make more money. These are people who have lived their lives and have tried to live good lives and need assistance here. And so we needed to be responsible to them. But somebody had come to me a couple of years ago and told me that Section 8 vouchers could be used in senior living apartments. Do you know if that's true?
Come on up.
I'm Beth Rice with Housing Services, and I'm Senior Housing Specialist, and I handle the waiting list.
Great.
A voucher can be used in any complex or with any landlord, as long as the landlord is willing to participate in the program and the rent is within the limit that we give to the tenant. As far as senior complexes, I know of one in Mesa that they divide out the rent so that we're subsidizing only the rent, but all other costs go back to the tenant.
Is it Fellowship Square?
No.
Okay, because somebody had mentioned that one specifically to me. I didn't know if they were.
Okay, then that makes two. Well, Fellowship Square is one.
Okay.
And the other one is Discovery Point.
Okay.
And what they do, and they both do a little bit different. Discovery Point, they can rent the apartment there, and we subsidize the apartment only. If the tenant chooses to participate in the dining room or the arts or whatever the other things are, then all those costs they must come up with.
Does the option exist for them to not participate in that aspect?
At Discovery Point,
so
yes.
So they could still live in the senior
right.
living
facility? Right, and then they just can't do the other stuff. Fellowship Square requires them to pay it even if they don't use it.
I see. Okay. Okay, well, thank you. That's helpful. I actually think that we need to get out of the apartment business, and the fact that you've been able to get the Section 8 voucher, you know, get that moved up to the top of the list, I think that that takes care of that issue for me. In terms of if we sell the apartments, do we sell it with leases in place, or do we proactively vacate the property prior to the close of escrow? I think we proactively vacate the property prior to the close of escrow. I think that we need to assist these tenants in all of the ways that you outlined, including, I mean, with some people, I think we need to contact potentially East Valley Senior Services or other entities to actually do handholding here, or our staff is going to need to do some handholding here. If somebody's been here a very long time, I think, you know, it's going to take a lot of sensitivity to deal with this appropriately. And in terms of marketing this, let me throw in one other thing, and you mentioned it in the staff report, but it's important, and that is, you know, taking the photographs, doing the documentation.
Yes.
This is a part of Mesa's history, and we need to make sure that we adequately document that part of our history. And in terms of doing it, I think that there are some opportunities to add value to the Site 17 property by potentially marketing them together. I don't have a problem if somebody wants to come in and do a mixed-use project that includes some component of if they get money from someplace else and they want to come in and do some part of subsidized housing, I don't have a problem with mixed housing stuff. I just don't want anybody to think that the city is going to hand over the land for a dollar or do any of those things. I don't want to leave somebody with that impression. I don't think that that's something that we have the opportunity. There might have been a day when that was true. I don't see that as being where we are. So did that cover everything there?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Councilmember Griswold.
We've heard from a lot of the tenants, and basically a lot of them, it's a great neighborhood, and it's a safe neighborhood, and I was really glad to see the voucher system. There was 25 households that were sort of caught in the transition. They didn't have a place to go, and they didn't have any subsidization to get there, so that's a real big step forward, and thank you very much for doing all that work opening up, because originally the Fed seemed to say, no, we won't do it, and so I think that's a good way to treat people, to transition to a nice, safe place to live with air conditioning and a good place to live near a bus station and some of the other things that were required, and driving people to be able to look at these places. Not everyone has a car in this area. I'm a little mixed. Mine was to sell it when you get people out of there and safely and transitioned, but I really don't want, as the Vice Mayor will say, a giant payday loan there or, you know, some other things. So I could see an RSP process, or just tell us what you're going to do. Give us the best offer. We'll look at it. Tell us what you're going to do. We're not going to hold your feet to the fire, but I'd like to see what some people propose to do on that. It may be part of my decision. The price would be part of the decision, too, et cetera. I think that covers basically there. I think we're going the right direction. One of the other questions I had was the moving allowance. Does that cover first and last month rent when someone goes to a new place? A lot of times that's required.
Mayor, Councilmember Griswold, it covers the security deposits.
Okay.
And oftentimes we found it's the security deposit that needs to be covered.
That's fine. As long as someone can get into this new, nicer place, that's fine. So I think you've done an excellent job. It's a tough transition. The only other concern I have is as we transition out and this gets less and less people in there, it's a fairly safe neighborhood now because everybody knows everybody. That we either put a police substation or a fire substation, or we have during this transition period, we have where it doesn't become a ghost town with both boarded up windows there, that becomes still a safe place to live for the next year in the transition period.
Mayor, Councilmember Griswold, we've already had discussions with the police department about beefing up patrols and security in the area, especially as it starts to vacate.
You're a step ahead of me as usual, so thank you.
Okay. And you were in favor of the moving allowance? Okay. Councilmember Summers.
Thank you, Mayor. I've had my comments throughout the I've seen this before. As a matter of fact, this whole calendar seemed to be a little bit of deja vu for me. But I swear we've been here before. My largest concern, as you're well aware, what happened with the 25 folks who were not on the Section 8, and you've successfully handled that very well. Thank you very much. So that, in my mind, leaves us with some more options. There was one question I did ask about folks who were ADA might have some additional moving expenses. There were some concerns about the school year and some accommodating some unforeseen circumstances that may not meet that 90 days. So I would be for the allowances and for the removal, and I'm also for the sale. I would ask, though, that we have to give staff some flexibility in the amount of money that we can use if there are some additional costs to ADA moving or something of that nature that's deemed relevant, and some flexibility as well in when folks move out, if we can adjust that up or down, depending, or particularly out a little bit for some unforeseen circumstance of the school year or whatever that is, that there be some flexibility built into this. Two ones that I circled is that we do vacate the property before the close of escrow. And I thought since we're able to do that, since we're able to put our get everybody on Section 8 and help them move out, that we should go ahead and sell the market on open property using a broker. Originally, I had thought that an RFP and giving some preferential treatment to some of the nonprofits was a good idea, but that was based on the fact that we had 25 people who were going to be through. Yeah, they weren't on they weren't on the list. But since we are now able to take care of that, I think. I don't see any obstacles with, at least that I can see right now, putting that on the open market.
Okay. Councilmember Jones?
It is past time that we get out of the housing business, and saying that with an understanding that we are sensitive to the needs of the people who are living there and who have been there for a long time, And for that reason, I think that we do need to vacate before we go on the market, simply because the sensitivity issue, and staff is already familiar with these individuals, working with them to relocate them. As far as how to go about selling the property, my preference would be the open market with a broker, but I need to make sure we have the protections in place that we don't get a payday loan center or something of that nature. So that's the catch in the whole deal, how we avoid that. So my preference would be just the open market, if we can have some kind of assurance of what goes in. So maybe the RFP, if done appropriately, we could get through that process better. But I'm not, I don't want to make it too restrictive as far as dictating what goes in there. I just want to dictate a couple of things that don't go in there. So is that all? What else do we have on there? Okay.
No, that was
basically
it.
What you needed, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Thank you.
Tom?
A couple of questions first. Is have we received federal money for this and used it on this property that puts any restrictions on the use to which we can put the proceeds?
We do have one issue that we're researching right now. We've asked HUD for a decision, and they haven't responded back yet. There's about $400,000 that was transferred between Section 8 and Escobedo. So it went from Section 8 to Escobedo between 95 and 2000. We have asked HUD if we have to pay that back with the proceeds from the sale. We haven't heard from them yet. The facility itself was funded through bonds, and I believe those have been paid back. So the only issue we're researching is that $400,000.
And again, how many acres does this?
11.
11.
11?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, on the Section 8 housing, how does that process work? Why is there a waiting list? Is it a question of qualifications, or is it a question of money, or what?
Mayor, Councilmember Rawls, there's only so many vouchers that each city is allocated based on population.
Okay.
And so we have 1,500 or so vouchers. And so right now, those are all being utilized as people transition off of Section 8 or they move to other communities, then they become open, and then we start pulling people from the waiting list to use those vouchers.
And we've experienced 52, at least an annual turnover of 52
yes.
over the past several
yes.
years.
Yes.
So that's why we feel comfortable that we can get the, if everybody who is on the waiting list or who's not on it but gets on, we can deal with those
yes.
within that year. Okay.
Kyle was the first one who gave any rationale that I could hear for why we want to do the transition everyone out before we close escrow. I was just wondering what are the pros and cons of that? You guys are recommending that we transition out before close of escrow. You put as an option that we don't have to do that, but there really isn't any discussion of the pros and cons between those two choices, and I'd like to hear what the thought process was.
Mayor, Councilmember Rawls, there were several reasons why we did that. One, I think it takes the human element out when you're selling the land. Two, it gives us control over what happens to the tenants. If we sell it with the leases in place, the tenants will have to deal with the new owners in terms of what happens to them, and we just felt that it was the right thing to do in terms of us taking care of the tenants and vacating the property before we sell it.
Okay. I'm in favor of selling. I'm in favor of selling on the open market and doing it with the transitional issue with the moving allowances makes sense. I'd like to hear an answer to the $400,000 question.
Yes.
To see, I know you're projecting that $160,000 cost for the moving allowances can be consumed or covered by the loss or the movement of people off the budget into other budgeted positions, meaning there's already money
yes.
there for them.
Yes.
But again, it's a question of timing in my mind. You know, are you going to move one person when you get a third of the people transitioned, and another one when the other one gets when the other third gets transitioned? So it's going to be a difficult moving target to keep that cost in line without getting too far out of hand. Because in the staff report, you talked about covering it out of contingency. I like the idea of covering it out of salary savings better, because it's tied to the project, and it makes more sense to me. So, but with those caveats, I think that answers all four questions. So.
Kyle? And I failed to thank staff for their preliminary work, getting the information in line before you made a presentation to us on how to take care of the vouchers and so forth. That's commendable. We appreciate that. You did it in your presentation, but we didn't really mention it up front here, is we have a lot of cost upcoming just to get this property in appropriate condition for the long term, mm-hmm. that we do not want to have to address. And we've done considerable cutting in the human services in the last couple of years, and this, even though I don't want to sound insensitive, but it's affecting a few people where this kind of money, if we were to expend it here, would just help a few, where really in our human services area with the nonprofits, that money is leveraged many times over and helps many, many more people. So I just cannot see expending a lot more money for a few when it isn't going to have the benefit that it should, except for those few. And again, I don't want that to sound insensitive, but that's the fact.
Mayor, yes. Can I just clarify? We've been talking about RFPs and open market, and there's kind of a mixed blend here. But I think actually we can get to what I hear from council. I think we can get there both ways. What I think we're proposing to do is we will actually, at the appropriate time, engage a broker who, as part of the process in soliciting interest for the project from the private sector, won't simply be just a price for the land and the improvements, but we will require that they also disclose what their anticipated plans are for the proposal, as opposed to sometimes in RFPs and other times, we may have been trying to prescribe what it was we were looking for. Mm-hmm. We're not prescribing that. We're essentially just asking them to disclose what they're anticipating that their development would be. So I hopefully that gets closer to what the majority was considering or thinking about. I just want to make sure that's clear.
I think you have some concurrence on that.
Okay.
Tom?
I mean, that gets closer to the model I don't want to do with what we did with those two buildings or the two locations, the two lots out in front of the Art Center, where, you know, you had to. But in my preference would be to go pure. But I think the majority is comfortable with what you're suggesting.
Okay. Right. And then if somebody wanted to keep them as they are today, and staff has anticipated $18,000 per unit to upgrade the 103 units. If I did my math right at the $1.9 million. It's roofing, electrical, insulation, plumbing. Those are a lot of code compliance issues that we would be facing later.
Mm-hmm.
So however we do this, I want to know how that cost, if they're going to try to preserve some of the units, is going to be handled, that they've anticipated.
Sure.
That
could be part of a group proposal. Sure.
Okay. Vice Mayor.
Yeah, and that picked up part of my concern. I don't want to now turn this over to somebody else to allow them to become a slum landlord. So that's number one. I don't feel like I have to do my normal rant on payday lenders, because I had two of my fellow council members who picked it up. So, but I also want to make sure that we're not excluding the nonprofits.
No.
Right.
There are some great proposals that are out there, and they're working to get funding together and make it all work. So. I think that they can participate in this, and so I think I've said everything now I need to say, Mayor.
Okay. Have the direction?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. One question here for Council. We have indicated that we are going into the mode of putting people over to Section 8 that are living there now over the next couple of years, vacating the property. Do you want to have any other type of open discussion with the public on this? Or not? I mean, it's city-owned land, they're leases, but just want to clarify. Tom?
Mayor, absent the housing board meetings and absent the committee meetings that have happened, I guess there's been two of those, right. I would say probably yes, but I think those views have been expressed in public settings to both our advisory committees and at least three of us. We have the minutes, we've had the input, so I don't feel a need for a more formal decision process than what we've had here.
Is everyone comfortable with that? Okay. Thank you very much. Item number two is hear a presentation, discuss and take action on the 2008 schedule for general plan major amendments.
Mayor and Council, I'm going to handle this discussion this morning. You may recall back in late December, early January, we were before the Council with some changes to our major general plan amendment process and received approval for the schedule for 2007. As a side note, you're probably aware already, but we received no applications for major plan amendments in 2007, so we won't be doing any of those this year. But as part of the discussion, following up on the major plan amendment from last year, we were looking for some improvements to the overall process. One of the ones that the Council was interested in seeing was starting the process earlier so we could get to the Council earlier in the year instead of November, December, try to get there earlier around the September time frame. We couldn't do that for the 2007 year because we were revising, updating the process a little bit too late to notify people of that. So we made a commitment to make that change starting in 2008. So that's why we're here this morning, is to get your approval of the schedule for 2008, which does have applications being submitted in January. We will start working with any applicants that are interested towards the end of this year to help them prepare those applications. There's really no other changes to the schedule, with the exception of addition of one additional neighborhood meeting that we've put in there. The revised schedule, as you'll recall, now has, after we get a first submittal, for a presentation to be made to both the P&Z Board and Council to get early feedback from these two bodies before they make their final formal submittal. We have thought it would be helpful once they get that feedback from these two bodies that they inform the neighborhood of any changes that they've made to the schedule. So that's one other change that's in here from the schedule this year. Otherwise, it's really the same, with just dates being moved to reflect the January start date. I'll answer any questions you may have.
I guess we have finally concluded that this council, or the majority of it, will be out of office in June of 08. My question is, what does this council look at prior to the June, and what does the new council look at? And if I was a major landholder and didn't like what this council's recommendations were, I would probably be out campaigning for the good replacements that would support my project. And I'm particularly interested in some large land holdings around General Motors. So how does that process work? What will we get to look at and kind of tweak before the new council obviously has final approval process on it?
Yes, Mayor and Council, the idea is that after the first initial submittal is made, that an overview presentation would be made to this board, giving you an idea of the general direction that the proposal is going, and to get allow this board then to give the applicant any high-level feedback on comments, thoughts of if it's a good direction or if there are some things that you see as being stumbling blocks that might be difficult to obtain approval of the request. We're not really holding a public hearing at that time. State statutes require that we hold one public hearing later in the year. And so it's just some general feedback that the applicant can choose to follow or ignore as they finalize their proposal for the formal review process that begins with the second submittal.
Okay. So if I'm looking at, excuse me, your schedule, Thursday, February 14th, tentatively, City Council study session looking at initial input, followed by submit revisions of to the proposal, actually by applicants. So by March 28th, we will know whether they did any corrections. When's the next action that the council looks at it in this?
Mayor, that would be in
April
September.
April 18th?
No, Mayor, that would be in September. We go through the 60-day review period, get that feedback, analyze it, we go to P&Z for their required two public hearings, and they make the recommendation, so it doesn't get back to council again until tentatively September.
Okay, so from the February 14th till September is kind of a gap there that's all the revisions. So when a new council comes in June, then they're going to look at it in September.
That's correct.
And our look at the major plan amendments is the February time frame. That's it.
Correct.
Okay. I you know, the new council has to live with it. That's just the nature of going from one council to the other. But I was curious. I've tracked some of these for a number of years and have an interest, so I will be probably in the audience then, I guess.
I was just going to say it probably causes a little disconnect in election years when you have this many people going off the council. But other than that, I think it's fine. And right. I think the agenda item is actually for a motion, isn't it?
Yes.
To approve. So I'll move approval of the new timeline.
Okay. All right. You have a motion and second discussion? Vice Mayor.
Well, I just wanted to say, Mayor, that before the council changes, perhaps we could get a change in the way we do business, and former mayors could have 5 to 10 minutes to speak in front of the council. My only comment on it.
Yeah. That's why they're former mayors. Any other questions, comments on this? Kyle.
Just a comment. With the changes, even though there's a one-time change now, for the future on elections, the cycle will be totally different with the end of the year. So it'll fall into line. It's just this one time.
That's true. One positive. Okay. All right. Have a motion and by Tom, seconded by the Vice Mayor, for approval of the timeline as submitted. No further discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Hear a presentation and discuss air quality issues.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. My name is Scott Boucher. I'm the Environmental Programs Administrator, and I'm here today to provide you a brief air quality update. You will receive in your June 25th Council packets a resolution that contains control measures that we will ask you to commit the city to implementing in your June 25th packet, and I will go over those briefly today. Just to give you a regulatory summary, the Clean Air Act is really the air quality regulation driver. There are national health-based standards that have been set, and today I'm going to talk about one in particular, which is the PM10 standard. I'd like to point out on this map the blue area that you see, which is basically the greater Phoenix metropolitan area, is our PM10 non-attainment area currently. PM10 is particulate matter that's less than 10 microns. It is a respiratory health hazard and is created typically through construction earth-moving activities. Just to give you a visualization, I've got some pictures here that have been taken by the environmental program staff previously of a construction site that obviously has not implemented the control measures and are creating a lot of dust during their earth-moving activities. And also when I discuss how a paved road creates large amounts of dust, this would be a perfect example of it. As you can see, there's a lot of dirt on the paved road that's been tracked out from a construction site. As cars drive over this dirt, it grinds up that dirt and re-entrains that dust up into the air. In 1996, the Maricopa County area was designated as serious non-attainment for PM10. I would like to point out, at this time, Mesa really did step up. We're the only city that has a dedicated particulate pollution ordinance at this time. Our ordinance really does follow the Maricopa County rule for earth-moving activities and for stabilization of vacant lots. So a lot of the things that I will be describing today, Mesa took action on several years ago with this particulate pollution ordinance. There are some other cities who haven't done that, so a lot of these control measures that I'll be discussing, which all cities in the non-attainment area are required to either commit to or justify the reasons why they're unable to commit to them, the city already committed to previously. So we submitted a state implementation plan in 1998 to show that we would gain attainment. We've been unsuccessful in getting attainment. We had continued violations through 2005 and 2006. Currently in 2007, there have been 4 exceedances at the monitors, but it is the opinion of the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality that they can justify that these were natural events due to high wind days. The adverse consequences associated with being designated non-attainment, some of the big ones are the possibility of the loss of transportation funding and also tighter control measures on industry, where they would be required for what's called 2-for-1 offsets. And it just makes it so that industry, it's we're not as a favorable place for industry to come to if they have these control measures on them. We also have to implement what's called a 5% reduction plan. This plan will show that we, Maricopa County will model that we can have 5% reductions in PM10 and that also we will gain attainment at the monitors. Just to give you an idea, I know some of you have seen these pie charts in the past of what the regional contributions of PM10 are. Just to give you an idea that the red section is construction, which accounts for almost 40% of the emissions, and that includes residential, commercial, road construction. The other large portion is nearly 30%, which is on-road activities, paved road dust and then unpaved road dust. What I showed you with the picture, that's how I know sometimes it's difficult to understand how a paved road can create dust, but the picture I showed you, the track out, is really how paved roads create so much dust. As I mentioned earlier, we'll have in your June 25th packet the resolution and control measures that Mesa will be committing to. I can let you know I'm a member of the Air Quality Technical Advisory Committee from MAG. We spent several months going over 74 proposed control measures in detail, looking at emission reductions and feasibility of implementation, cost effectiveness. Of those 74 proposed control measures, the Air Committee recommended 41 of them for implementation to the MAG Management Committee. Of those 41, 9 of them are required for implementation by local governments. The other 32 will be implemented by the state, the county, and also private industry. Some of the other 32 do affect the city because many times, as you know, we're a contractor. We have large construction projects, so those other measures that affect construction will also affect the city as we do construction projects. In March 14th, the MAG Management Committee approved the list and recommended it to Regional Council, and then Regional Council approved it with some slight modifications, asking the Air Committee to go back and look at some of the control measures that they had not recommended and look at them in a little bit more detail. In August, when these measures are submitted to MAG, they will model them to make sure that we will receive our 5% reductions. And then this plan is due to the EPA in December of this year. Just to go over some of the control measures that I'll be discussing, public education is the first one. I did give you a brochure from Maricopa County in their Bring Back Blue campaign. These brochures have been, City of Mesa has been working with Maricopa County on their public education campaign. We're distributing those at our household hazardous waste events. They also were distributed at City Hall, at the mall, and other events that the city has, really trying to work cooperatively with Maricopa County on their new public education campaign. On Council's direction, Environmental Programs has increased the level of training for city field staff. We went from training approximately 200 employees annually on dust awareness to 400 field employees every year. Anybody with access to the World Wide Web can file online dust complaints, and also the police department has been working on public education for off-road use in desert areas. Some of these that I'll get to now, it's going to hit on our particulate pollution ordinance, restricting vehicle use and parking on vacant lands. We already have that in place with our particulate pollution ordinance. Something that I'd like to point out is we do inspect city vacant lots on a monthly basis to ensure that they're in compliance not only with our own ordinance but also with the Maricopa County rules. And code compliance has some codes for parking on unpaved surfaces, which they actively enforce also. Paving stabilized unpaved roads, shoulders, and alleys. Environmental Programs has been working with transportation for numerous years now on inventorying those unpaved roads and shoulders, alleys, and keeping them stabilized. We have $150,000 budgeted annually for the stabilization. I would like to point out that beginning in 07-08, that will be paid for with the new environmental compliance fee. That $150,000 will be paid for with the environmental compliance fee. Sweeping streets with PM10 efficient street sweepers. Again, this is one where the city has been proactive. Our entire fleet is PM10 efficient for street sweepers, and we already have contract language that requires the contractor use a PM10 efficient street sweeper when they're sweeping the streets. The use of off-road vehicles, again, our particulate pollution ordinance and our inspections, and also the police department has taken an active role in public education. We also work with the real estate division on making sure if we do see signs of off-road activity, we've got signs on our property, and in some cases, we put up fences or berms to prevent people from accessing those properties. Limiting speed limits to 15 miles per hour. As I noted in the previous slide, we have less than 1 mile of unpaved roads currently. We've really actively paved all the roads that we had. These roads have very low vehicle usage on them. I would like to point out, though, that city staff is working with Maricopa County on identifying county roads that are located in the city of Mesa that are unpaved and trying to help them prioritize what roads they should be paving. They've asked for our assistance on that, and so we've decided to help them out in that project. Also, paving or stabilized unpaved parking lots. This is one where we're going to take a look at our particulate pollution ordinance. Right now, there's a square footage requirement that it be greater than 5,000 square feet. We're looking at removing the possibility of removing that square footage requirement, and the driver on that, there's presently a air quality bill in the Senate Bill 1552. And in that bill, they're looking at not having a square footage requirement for stabilizing unpaved parking lots. Currently, the Maricopa County rule requires that it be greater than 5,000 square feet. That's kind of where we came up with that number when we initially came up with our ordinance. But we're looking at the possibility of removing that. In 1552, they're prohibiting the use of leaf blowers on high pollution advisory days. Currently, the city's contract with landscapers does prohibit them from using leaf blowers on high pollution advisory days, and our facility staff works diligently on getting those notices out to the landscapers in time so that they know the following morning that they're not to use the leaf blowers. Also prohibiting blowing of landscape debris into public roadways. One requirement that may hit the city because we do some work on maintenance activities is that there'd be additional training that Maricopa County would put on for our dust control coordinators.
You were talking about our contractors using leaf blowers on high pollution advisory days. Does that also apply to private citizens using leaf blowers on high pollution advisory days?
Currently, it is that the cities and the county would, in their contracts, not be allowed to have, they would have to not let their contractors use leaf blowers on high pollution advisory days.
Okay. Because it seems like the majority of leaf blowers that are being used aren't being used by our contractors.
Right. There is a requirement in the bill that the landscapers, if you are paid to use a leaf blower, that you would have to go through a training once every 3 years on how to use a leaf blower properly. And that's going to be put on by Maricopa County.
Well, that should be entertaining. Okay. Thank you.
Also, in 1552, there's a requirement for a parking ordinance, which we have, the use of PM10 street sweepers, and ordinances for off-road vehicle use. One of the requirements is they're going to reduce the daily trips for implementing plans to stabilize roads, shoulders, and alleys. We currently meet this requirement through our work with transportation, and we continue to work with them on updating those plans. Also, they would prohibit fires, recreational fires on no burn days, and increase fines for violation of burn restrictions. This comes from Maricopa County, has had some troubles with business owners around monitors that have continually had open burning, and currently the fine limit is $25 per violation. So it's been financially beneficial for them just to burn it and get a $25 fine rather than trying to dispose of it properly. So. I would like to point out that we still have our environmental hotline, 644-3599, where you can call in 24/7 any dust complaints, and that's really one of the things that we hit on with our dust awareness training for field staff. It's to call environmental programs, let us know if they see something, and then the environmental staff will follow up. That is my presentation at this time. I'll open it up for any questions.
Okay. At the March 28th meeting of the Regional Council, we had our first split vote on one of the control measures. Somebody added an amendment, and it had to do with the larger construction sites, and maybe it was aggregate mining to have air quality samplers that were non-binding samplers, but that they would put monitors in. The amendment didn't pass, so the recommendation went forward. The amendment was to kind of strip that. It was one of the first ones I've ever been at MAG where out of 40 people, it was a 20-20 vote, so it didn't pass. So that was one. The other one, that there was some discussion about the tracking, taking it from 50-foot to 25-foot allowable. But does that apply? And the question was about multiple entrances into the plant.
Yes, that would be cumulative. So if you had, you know, 10 feet from one entrance and 15 feet from another entrance together, that would exceed that 25-foot.
Yeah, and the logic of that is 10 foot out, does it really get in the traffic lane or not? And with multiple entrances, is that better? And I just wanted to compliment the Air Quality Subcommittee on some of the, that they finally looked at agricultural measures and other things that California had been doing and we had not implemented in the past. So, but it's a serious issue that if you don't come into compliance, the fines and potentially even the elimination of highway funds is a big number, and I think they did that in, I want to say, Atlanta or someplace.
Yes,
actually
Atlanta
got
Park.
Sanctioned. So, right. Questions, comments? Vice Mayor.
When you look at our unpaved alleys, have you determined, you know, what amount of generation of dust you're getting off of there, and if there are any of our alleys that are in our, that are getting more than 100 trips a day? I mean, I don't think we've been out there. Lenny's shaking his head. He doesn't think we have any alleys that are like that. Okay. And in terms of people blowing things into the street, once again, I'm assuming from your language that that's part of the contract that we have to have with our contractors, that any government entity. But I thought we actually had a regulation in Mesa that said that, that private citizens are not allowed to blow their junk into the street.
That's correct. We do, even through our stormwater ordinance, that they're not allowed to place any pollutants into the street, and sediment is considered a pollutant in our stormwater ordinance. So any leaves or dirt, which would typically be associated with a leaf blower, that would be in violation of our stormwater ordinance.
It seems to me like that might be a good one to remind people of again in our open line or some other way. Because there are things that, I mean, I get contacted, and that's why I knew it was an ordinance. I think I talked to Christine about it not so long ago because somebody contacted me and said, my neighbors are all doing this. Is that okay? And the answer is no, it's not okay.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it. But I think if we put language in that says you aren't allowed to put pollutants in the street, most people wouldn't think of their dust and their leaves as pollutants.
Right.
You know?
We can work on a public education campaign on that also.
And then I guess, you know, some voluntary information out to those people we know who are in the landscape business in our community that shares with them, you know, that people who contract with us are doing this. You might want to think about this because it's impacting our air quality. If you can do other things on those days that are high pollution advisory days other than using your leaf blower. Is there anything like a PM10 leaf blower alternative?
Vacuums it up.
The vacuums?
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about that, too. Okay, thank you.
Rex.
What is the penalty for the area with gas tax money or air road money if we're out of compliance for so many days?
In my discussions with MAG, their estimates are over a five-year period, it could be up to $1.1 billion in loss of federal highway funds.
Where are the monitors the feds put in for the judging our air pollution?
They are located throughout the valley.
There are, we have one in Mesa?
Yes, we do have one in Mesa that is for PM10, and it hasn't violated the standard in, I can't even recall the last time that it actually had a violation. So.
And the ones in Phoenix are located?
There's one at 43rd Avenue, and the other one, I believe, is at 35th Avenue in Durango, are where they're very close to each other. The two monitors that violate continuously.
The ones in a field they plow, and the other ones in a dry riverbed next to a gravel?
Well, they're both by the riverbed, and they're in areas that are very industrial. There's salvage yards. There is a sand and gravel operation there. There is a lot of unpaved shoulders, but the city of Phoenix has spent millions of dollars paving those unpaved shoulders.
Couldn't they move the monitors to really see what the air is like rather than what the dust in a gravel pit's like? Wouldn't that be cheaper than paving all of
the monitors are set up, and the requirements, you can't control specifically to the monitors. You can implement control measures, and the way that we kind of can say it is that they implement it in high emission areas. But I will say there are also two other monitors, one down by Buckeye and one in the Higley area, that have had violations in the past several years.
Those are also farm fields there?
Well, those areas, the Higley one especially, I am familiar with. The 202 just was put in by there, and most of the farmland is now becoming houses. So there's a lot of construction going on in that area. But there is also a small kind of retail sand and gravel operation that's down there. There's the railroad tracks that run by it. So there are some other dust-generating activities in that area.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Right. Any other questions? Right. Thanks for the update on it.
Thank you.
Four has been deleted.
We're going to get you brief counseling over that.
Yeah. Five, acknowledge receipt of minutes of various boards and committees.
So moved.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All right. Any opposed? Passes. Your reports on meetings and our conferences attended. Kyle, looks like you came dressed today. I brought a hat, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a wonderful night last night for the ribbon cutting of the Bass Pro Shop, and a number of us were there and had a good time and mingled with an awful lot of folks walking through that big place. It was a wonderful thing.
Good. Well, I have a lifetime hunting and fishing license, and if you haven't been to this store, try to go this weekend. The Bass Pro Shop store is probably one of the best in the nation, and it's pretty impressive inside. The turnout was wonderful. I thought they lived up to their expectations of what we had hoped to have a world-class facility being built. The fish tanks and the archery ranges and everything that they have in there are just make sure that when you go, you have plenty of time, because it takes a while to go through that, and there is also a restaurant that's there, so it was a very impressive facility. I think everybody's looking forward to the synergy that the 101 and 202 with the Wave Yard, if that is built and successful with resort hotels, this is going to be a dynamic place for Mesa. So a big occurrence in Mesa last night with the opening. Kyle?
I was going to say, probably one of the busiest places in that store last night was the NASCAR simulators. They had a big, long line and folks enjoying a wipeout on a track. Very nice.
In other words, you couldn't get to the front of the line. You had to wait there for a while. That's Rex.
Yeah, for sales tax, I enjoyed the lines to buy the $20,000 bass boats. So I thought that was a good thing. Also, yesterday I took a tour of the new McDonald helicopter civilian plant tour at Falcon Field, and looked at, they've spent $250 million investment on that, new owners, and they've increased the employees from about 90 to, at the end of this year, be about 400, with an average job of about 60,000 plus in wages. Also, I got to speak last week at the graduating of the East Valley High School class, so it's been a interesting few weeks, and kids are finally out of school, as you can tell at Bass Pro yesterday.
Vice Mayor.
Thanks, Mayor. Since you all said nice things about my district, I just wanted to say what a joy it was to be there last night. I was standing next to a gentleman before we went in to sit down for the ribbon-cutting part. There were just a handful of us sitting, and as an aside, there were a handful of us sitting and everybody else standing behind us, and I thought we might get stampeded. Because there were so many people who wanted to get in there. But I was standing next to a gentleman who was from Northwest Phoenix, and he said he had been waiting patiently as he drove to work every day and was watching how it was coming, and he could hardly wait, and he was just waiting for the moment that the doors opened, because it was his intention to go in and buy everything in the store, he said. So I thought, please come from Northwest Phoenix, from any other place, and please feel free to buy everything in the store. They'll restock it. The only difficulty I had last night was getting my husband out of the fine gun room, which I can see I'm going to have to start saving in a major way for Christmas presents in the future. Thank you.
Right. And Father's Day is just around the corner. Yeah. Right. Okay, scheduling meetings and general information.
Thank you, Mayor. Just a reminder to the Public Safety Committee that there is a meeting Tuesday, June 12th at 3:30. And, of course, we'll have our study session on the 14th. I know there's a few that will not be here. And then our council meeting for our second council meeting for the month of June will be June 25th. Thank you.
Do we have any requests to speak this morning?
There are no requests, Mayor.
All right.
Move for adjournment.
All right. We have a motion and second to adjourn the study session. All in favor?
Session.
Aye.
Aye.
Got it. I now need to call a special council meeting to order for the purposes of convening an executive session. We have a motion and second to that effect.
Have any meetings.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All right.